Hello and welcome to the Student Loan Planner podcast. This is Travis Hornsby, founder of Student Loan Planner. Thanks for joining me this week. I am super stoked because we're going to do a 2020 tax guide episode today. So buckle up. Taxes, so exciting, right? Oh my gosh, I cannot think of anything more exciting than talking about taxes. Just kidding. I can think of probably 500,000 or 600,000 different things that are better than talking about taxes, right? The thing that gets me excited about talking about taxes, though, is not just talking about taxes. It's what I could do with that money if I was not having to pay more taxes than I legally ought to be paying. We had a good saying when I was growing up. Basically, the goal is that you should pay every bit of tax that you are supposed to pay, but no more, because that's the goal, is to legally pay what you owe and then not pay more than you're supposed to. And a lot of people, in my experience, do pay way more in taxes than they're supposed to be paying. You know, I like to think of this as like, well, maybe that's a good thing, right? Because maybe you are okay paying higher taxes. But here's something to think about. Apparently, on the Treasury website, you can actually hit this button that says pay down the debt of the United States. And so every year, I think that they get about $1 million or something like that that's donated to pay down the debt of the U.S. Treasury. And if you think about that, in a country with an economy that's like $20 trillion, the fact that only $1 million of that is made in donations to paying down the U.S. debt, that's telling you that nobody wants to pay more taxes than they absolutely have to. I mean, that's what that really tells you, is people are not into the idea of paying extra tax for no reason. So I thought I would start out just kind of talking about taxes a little bit to just understand what it is you're actually paying and why. And then maybe later on in the episode, we'll get to more kind of some long-term tax planning things because of what you didn't do this year. And then we're going to talk about literally things that you should do right now, more towards the end of the episode, if you're trying to save money as a student loan borrower with really large taxes. First off, let's just talk about this concept of adjusted gross income, AGI. That is the magic number that so many things in our lives are based on, in terms of qualifying for government programs, in terms of what tax rate you're going to be falling into, in terms of if you're going to hit certain thresholds for can you buy a house or not. I mean, that AGI number is your taxable income. When you're talking about taxable income, the U.S. has a very progressive tax structure, right? Maybe not as progressive as some countries like Sweden or Denmark or something like that, but it's a very progressive tax structure, which means that if you're poor, you don't really pay very much in income taxes. If you were very rich, you know, I mean, there's all these stories about people who are rich that don't pay taxes, but actually the rich pay a very large amount of income taxes. I think the amount of the 1% pay is something like, I want to say it's 40% of all income taxes or something like that. Now, granted, you could argue that they should be paying more. That's certainly a political argument that's happening in our country right now. But in terms of income taxes, the higher the taxable income that you have, the higher tax bracket that you fall in. So this is like a basic tax 101 kind of thing. So feel free to kind of fast forward me or tune me out if this is really basic to you. But a lot of people, I'm shocked, don't really know this. So if you're single, you're going to get right now about a $12,000 standard deduction, give or take. So that means you can earn 12 grand doing stuff that makes you income and literally pay $0 in taxes on it. So that's right off the first batch, right? So once you take into account your deductions above that, if you make a dollar above that standard deduction or whatever your itemized deductions are, if you're itemizing, very few people are doing that these days, by the way, with the new tax reform. Every dollar you earn above your deductions from $0 to $10,000, you're going to pay taxes at a rate of 10%. Let's just say that you're taking the standard deduction and you're taking a $12,000 deduction, okay, just for the purposes of this show. That's probably what 90% of people on this show are doing, is taking the standard deduction. You're basically at a point where, okay, 12K, and then on top of that, the next 10,000 is taxed at 10%. So that means that up to 22,000 of income, if you're single, you're going to get hit with a 10% federal income tax. But then on the next $30,000, you're going to get hit at a 12% tax rate. So that's really not that different from 10, right? So in other words, I'm not going to say this for every tax bracket. Don't worry. Okay. But for the next 30K of income that you're going to have, it's a 12% tax rate. So in other words, 22,000 to 62,000 of income as a single person, you're paying 12% income tax on. But now here's where things start to jump up a lot. So once you make above that level, basically, so, and I think I might have misspoke too. It's basically 22,000 to 52,000 is what I should have said. So 22,000 to 52,000 is taxed at 12% if you're taking the standard deduction as a single person. But now, remember, there's this thing called marginal tax rate. It means what is that next dollar that you earn getting taxed at? So if you think, okay, you're making 52,000, but you're going to make an extra dollar, what does that extra dollar get taxed at? It's going to get taxed at 22% with the current tax rates. So everything you earn above 52,000 up to about 92,000 is going to get taxed at about 22%. Now, when you're talking 92,000 to, let's see, about 172,000, you're going to get taxed at 24% as a single person. And then the tax brackets keep jumping up. So I'm going to use super rough numbers now just to make things a little bit more simplistic, easier, right? So once you're making over about 170-ish, you're paying 32% in taxes on every additional dollar, right? So that means the income, the first bit of income that you earned is actually taxed at pretty low income tax rates. But that next amount of money that you earn is actually taxed at much, much higher tax rates. And then when you're into the, you know, over $200,000 income range, which, you know, a fair number of our listeners are, certainly a lot, most people are going to be in that five-figure income range. But there are people that listen to the show that are dentists, doctors, that physicians that make in that over 200K range. As a single person, you're going to get hit with that 35% tax bracket. And then the top tax bracket for a single person is about 500K and up. 37% is the current top tax bracket. It used to be about 40 back during the President Obama administration. With married filers, this is where things get real interesting. So basically, if you make less than about $350,000 as a married couple, then, you know, the government doesn't really care that much if you're single or married for tax purposes. Now, this is if you both make about the same income. The thing that you'll see is when you're making like below 300K, like zero to 300K, the benefits of being married for tax reasons, if one spouse makes way more money than the other, is actually really high. Like, it's actually a really great thing to be married. If one spouse is making like 20K and one's making 200, it's wonderful to be married. You're going to save a ton of money on taxes because, you know, instead of putting that single person in that 200K tax bracket world because of our progressive income tax structure, that married couple is going to be in a way lower tax bracket world as a married couple because your combined income, basically the government just says, okay, take two people and double the brackets. And that's roughly what it is for married couples. Now, what's interesting is when you start making over, you know, in terms of federal income taxes, when you start making over about 350K, this is where it gets really stupid to be married. Financially speaking, it's really kind of amusing. Like, if you look at the tax code, it's kind of like the government really does not enjoy high income people being married to one another. And there's actually some professors from, I think, Penn Wharton Business School that specifically didn't get married because they're like, it's so irrational based on the tax code, right? So like, they were costing themselves, I want to say, like $5,000 to $10,000 in extra taxes by being married. So they were like, well, screw it. Why would we be married then? It is kind of funny. Most people I've noticed do not think that way. People talk about like strategic divorce sometimes for your student loans. And I like to joke with clients like when that find themselves in a situation where they're paying more because they're married than if they were single on their student loans. You know, sometimes we have discussions about like strategic divorce. Like, is that something that is even remotely on the table or not? I like to joke that I would get a strategic punch in the face if I suggested that to my wife, if we could save money on our student loans, right? So it really does depend on your individual situation as to what you want to do. So anyways, we know that, you know, if you're single or if you're married, you know, if you're making below 300K something, then there's not too much weirdness in terms of the tax rates. Like, there's not super shocking stuff, but I do think it's pretty shocking when folks bust their butt to get an extra 10K or 20K or pick up some extra shifts. Because if you realize what you're getting taxed at, you might not do it. Because remember that first, you know, as a single borrower, right, that first 170 something thousand is getting taxed at pretty low rates. But when you're getting above that income level, you're starting to get taxed at pretty high rates. And I'll show you an example later as to why, you know, if you're losing half of your income in taxes, you know, you might be kind of tempted to just play some more video games or relax or take some more vacations or have some more time off with your kids or more time with your significant other. There's something to that. You know, in fact, I feel like if people understood the tax code as deeply as the people doing their taxes do, I think that there'd be a lot of people that would be pushing for part-time work just because it's pretty amazing how that extra fifth day that you're working that week, you earn way less of it that you actually get to take home than the other few days a week you're working. So that's like tax rates in general, right? But what if you have investment income? So this might pique your interest a little bit. Did you know that you could make, if all of your income is from capital gains and dividends, did you know that you could make, as a married couple, up to about $104,000 of income before you would have to pay anything in income taxes? Literally zero. So that's pretty interesting. The reason for that is if your total income is between $0 and $80,000 before deductions, then you pay a 0% capital gain or qualified dividend tax rate. You know, you get a 12K deduction if you're single, 24K if you're married, I believe. And just real rough math, that basically means that if all your money's coming from dividends and capital gains, you can make 50K if you're single or 100K if you're married and literally pay zero in taxes at the federal level. Now, once you earn above that, then you might have to pay about 15%. And if you are making really high income, then you're going to have to pay 20%, and you're going to get hit with the Affordable Care Act tax. That's an additional 4% on capital gains and dividend income. And so this is kind of another interesting thing that I don't think a lot of people kind of think about, because it doesn't hit your average person, but it certainly could hit a lot more people than you would think. So let's just pretend that you've got two people married that are making $150,000 each, which is, you know, good income. Okay. And a lot of people, if you're listening to this, you don't make that. This show applies to you too. Okay. But I just want to give you this quick example. If you are both making $150,000, if you're single, the Affordable Care Act tax does not apply to your dividends and capital gains. So you could actually pay, you know, no tax on your investment income based off of the Affordable Care Act. But if you're married, the limit is not double what it is for a single person. It's only $250,000 is the limit of income before you're required to pay an extra 4% in taxes on your investments. So then that means that basically if you're married, you're going to get hit with this Affordable Care Act tax really fast compared to if you're single. So there's all kinds of things like that in the tax code where getting married is financially probably a bad decision if you're both higher income earners. And it's very interesting because it's kind of like the tax code rewards married couples where you have like a stay-at-home wife or stay-at-home husband. The tax code like really rewards that, but the tax code really does not reward, you know, very high income couples for having two spouses working. So that's just a real interesting thing. And I've never understood why that is, because you'd think that you would want to encourage everyone to work as much as they want to work versus, you know, having progressive tax rates, that's one thing, but to kind of penalize married couples that are high earners, it's an interesting policy choice. I think that maybe one of the reasons that happens is because, you know, married couples that are higher earners actually have some of the greatest wealth building of basically any demographic period. Like if you want to get rich in a hurry, be a high income married couple, because you're sharing the cost of all these things. You know, if you do have children, you have like that security of financial security and everything. So it's just, I guess that's why they do it. But just be aware of that. If you're like those Wharton professors that all you care about is your tax rate, you're both high income earners, you might not want to get married. So that's capital gains and dividends. Now, how do you get those, right? How do you actually get some of that for yourself? Remember, I've talked sometimes about investing in the total stock market index fund, VTSAX, and the total international stock market index fund, VTIAX. So those are Vanguard index funds, and you can open up a brokerage account at Vanguard and invest in those mutual funds, and they're going to pay you dividends. And in some cases, most of those dividends should be qualified, which just means that they're qualified for you paying a lower tax rate on them than you would otherwise have to pay. So that's that, you know, 0 to 20-something% tax rate that you'd have to pay on your dividends. And then, you know, if you have any capital gains, and you have to pay capital gains as well, which is that 0 to 20-something% rate as well. I should have probably put this at the very beginning of the episode, but I'm not your CPA. So full disclosure, this is just for your entertainment only. So anyhow, if you have capital gains and dividend income, what I think is so cool about that is if you did just rush to getting a certain level of assets that you've saved up, you know, you might be paying like 40, 50% on your taxes, you know, in terms of your next taxable dollar that you earned, but your capital gains income could be taxed at almost nothing. So there's a lot of strategy behind all this if you're real careful. So what about your total tax rate? Okay. I'm going to give you a couple different examples of this. Now, you know, I get kind of accused sometimes of, you know, hey, I like your podcast, but golly, you talk about high income earners all the time. And, you know, I want you to talk about something for me because I make $50,000 a year, right? I need to do a better job of that. Let's just say, for example, that you're making like $60,000 a year, just an example, and you live in California. And let's say you're single. So $60,000 a year. So you're going to be in the 22% federal tax bracket. Okay. 22% federal tax bracket. That's on every dollar you earn over about 50,000, okay, give or take a couple thousand. So every dollar you earn above 50,000, you're paying 22% federal tax. Now in California, I believe the tax rate's around 9 for income taxes when you're making over 50. So that's 31% right there. Okay. And then let's say that you're pursuing the PSLF program. Let's say that you're a nursing assistant or something like that working at a hospital. I think I couldn't say nurse in California making 60K because I know nurses in California make a lot more than that in a lot of cases. But let's say you're making $60,000 doing PSLF, then that means that you have an additional 10% tax because PSLF is taking 10% of your taxable income, right? So that means every dollar you earn over like 50,000, you're going to get hit with 9 California, 22 federal, and then 10 for your PSLF. So that's 41%. What's kind of interesting there is that 41% is completely avoidable if you put that money into a retirement account. If, for example, you figured out when your 22% tax bracket starts, then you could just put, if you have limited funds, you could put just the amount over that start of the 22% tax bracket. So in other words, basically about $10,000, give or take, right? Like 50 to 60K, that income amount, that 10 grand could go into a retirement account. You're saving 41%. Now, if you just maximized your retirement account, that 10K that's in that 22% bracket, you'd save 41% on. And then remember that the tax bracket below that is 12% instead of 22, which is 10% lower. So that means that say you maxed out your retirement account, your 401k or 403b at work, and you put in the full $19,500 for 2020, then that would save you, you know, the 22% federal rate on the income in the 22% bracket, but it would only save you the 12% federal rate for that income in the below $50,000 range. So you'd save 41% on some of your contribution and then 31% on the other part of the contribution. So that's the part of the tax that you can avoid. The part of the tax that I don't believe you can avoid if you're a worker is you have Medicare and Social Security tax. So that usually works out to about 7.5%. So let's say that you are at, you know, the 41% total tax rate. That's the stuff that you could avoid. Now, the 7.5%, that's coming straight out of your paycheck. So the 7.5%, so that's going to be about 48.5, so 49%. So let's just say 50 and round up. A person who's making 60 grand in California, let's say that they have the flexibility to work, you know, 5 days a week or 4 days a week or something. That'd be a big if. But your extra day of work that's getting you from 50 to 60K, you're getting taxed at 50%. All right. I mean, at least on that marginal rate. Now, your effective tax rate is going to be way lower, right? And that's because your effective tax rate is your overall taxes divided by your overall income. And that tax rate can be pretty low because of how much of those low tax brackets you fill up first before you hit the higher tax brackets. Because remember, let's say you make 200, you know, something thousand. Let me use real tax numbers here for a second. So let's say you make 220,000 or something, and there's only about 10K in the 32% tax bracket. Well, only that 10K is taxed at 32%, but the rest is taxed at those lower tax brackets. So that's like that idea of that marginal tax system that we have in America. And there really are so many tax brackets. There used to be even more than this, I think. But I mean, it really does get kind of confusing. And you know, again, it's like if you're looking at your income, and you're like, well, shoot, okay, 50% taxes. Heck, maybe if I'm only making half of what I think I'm making, you know, for working that extra day in that week or picking up that extra shift, maybe I'd rather spend that time with my family or doing hobbies or something like that instead. In terms of your total tax rate, so let's talk about, you know, somebody that's making more money than that. Shout out to y'all, five-figure folks, five-figure income earners. I wanted to make sure I gave you at least that example. Again, I want to do more focus on folks making five figures, like low to mid five figures, because I know that we have a big group of folks that listen to the podcast in that category. Let's talk briefly about the people making more than that. So if you have $200,000 a year in California, then you're going to be paying more, right? You're going to be paying perhaps significantly more. let's just say, look up single tax brackets here. Yeah, so if you're making 200K, you're basically about 30 of that is in the 32% tax bracket. Okay, so that's 32% federal tax bracket. So then you're at about 9 for California, give or take. All in, 32 plus 9, you're at basically 41, right? So 41%, and then tack on your PSLF tax of about 10%, or your, you know, IDR tax in general. You could, this would apply if you're doing 20 years for, you know, a taxable private sector loan for getting a strategy too. 41, add in the 10, now you're at 51% in taxes, and you could actually avoid that by putting money into retirement. So if you put your money into a 401k plan, as long as it's a traditional and not a Roth, a traditional, then that would come off of your taxable income. And let's say you're saving it close to the 20K max. Well, that's going to cost you about half of that, about 10K in take-home pay. So that really is a pretty big difference. And you really need to focus on, if you're a student loan borrower that's going for a forgiveness plan, I really don't recommend Roth. I mean, in very rare cases, does it make sense to do Roth as a student loan borrower? You know, the only time it does is if you are already maxing out all your pre-tax accounts and you just have money that literally lying around and you know, really want to put it into a Roth, then go right ahead, right? But, you know, if you're like making, you know, $30,000 a year or $40,000 a year in a state without an income tax, then maybe it makes sense to do Roth. But, you know, really, whenever you're getting taxed and you're getting tax savings at more than 30%, I don't know why that you would do the after-tax Roth version and not just take the deduction up front, right? I mean, if you look at some of the math behind that, everybody thinks tax rates are going way up. Guess what? Like, you're probably going to be able to make plans to pay less in taxes if you're not super rich. And if you are super rich, then maybe you'll just want to donate your distributions from your retirement to charity. And then in which case the charities are better off, right? So I'm a fan of like focusing on doing the maximum and all these traditional pre-tax accounts, taking the deduction today and, you know, not worrying about the fact that you'll pay a lot in taxes later on. I think that, you know, for people that are in student loan forgiveness situations, your goal is to reduce your taxable income as much as possible to pay as little in income taxes as possible, but also to reduce your student loan payment. The other thing is that's actually not the total tax rate you pay. So remember that 200K a year person. So you're also going to pay Medicare tax. And if you're employed, that's about 1.5%. And then also you're going to have Social Security tax. And then that's going to be 7.5% on the first 130K of wages, I think it is. So that does stop. Social Security tax currently is capped and it no longer goes above the wage amount when you make over that certain dollar amount. So that's kind of an interesting thing too, because they're talking about, you know, eliminating that payroll tax cap. So if they did that, let's say they eliminate the payroll tax cap, so your employer actually has to pay the other 7.5%, or the other, you know, it's technically, I guess, Social Security's 6 approximately, and then the employer has to pay about 6 as well. Combined, Medicare and Social Security taxes are like 15%. The employer has to pay about half of that. For the, you know, Social Security payroll amount, if you uncapped that, you know, what you'd have is somebody going for, you know, a loan forgiveness strategy would have 51% taxes just from all their student loans, state, federal taxes. And then on top of that, you'd also have to pay 15% for Social Security and Medicare. So you'd be at 66% in taxes. That's pretty high. and that's if you're doing the one that's 10% of your income, you know, pay as you earn or revised pay as you earn. If you did income-based repayment, IBR, then you'd be at 15%. So instead of 66% tax rate, you'd be at like 71% if they uncapped that payroll tax. But you're still at, you know, 50-something, over 50-something. And if you're self-employed, well, then you have to pay your Social Security, Medicare tax, the employer side of that yourself. So that's pretty painful. And you kind of realize like how expensive Medicare and Social Security are when you actually are self-employed and you feel the full burden of that tax, because that's a high hit. Now, there is something that's kind of interesting. This is why I really encourage people to become business owners. You can actually get out of paying legally, get out of paying some of your Medicare and Social Security taxes if you're a high earner, because Medicare and Social Security taxes are really mostly based on wages. And so what a lot of people do, a lot of you listening that are dentists really are very commonly set up as S corporations. So what that means is basically it's just a pass-through entity where you're going to own your own dental practice. But what they're going to say is they're going to make a corporation and they're going to have your corporation pay you, let's say, $120,000, right, as a salary from that corporation. So the reason people do that is because it allows you to avoid paying the 3% Medicare tax on all income above 120K, because it's just based on that limited wage that you gave yourself, and it allows you to avoid Social Security tax on any wages above that. So a lot of people will do that strategy. Accountants set that up for folks, and it does save people money. Again, it's kind of interesting because it just shows you how when you're a business owner, you just have way more flexibility than people who are not a business owner to lower your taxes. Another kind of thing that is interesting for the student loan reform side, they were talking about eliminating the student loan rules and making it so that you could just do a deduction out of your paycheck. So this would be for future borrowers if it passed, but it's probably not going to pass until after the election, if even then, because the person who's putting it forward is the retiring Republican senator of the leader of the Senate Education Committee, and he's retiring. So, but his proposal was to just do 10% out of your paycheck. And if you did that, think about this, you could go open a business and you could get the business to give you kind of an artificially low wage, and you could just pay 10% out of a, 60K income on your, 150K profit or something like that. So in other words, you're paying, $400 or $500 a month on your student loan with no tax bomb. Why would anybody pay off their student loans if they borrowed a bunch? They wouldn't. Just remember that as a business owner, you always have a lot more flexibility. So let's just talk about this for a second, right? If you're a student loan borrower and you're going for forgiveness, anything over 100K of income, if you're single, or over 200, if you're married, and you're kind of getting hammered on taxes. I mean, not as much as, Sweden or Denmark or something like that. But keep in mind that we also don't get all the benefits that, they have in Sweden and Denmark too, right? And there's no universal healthcare. There's no amazing paternity or maternity leave policies nationwide. There's not as much paid time off. So that's pretty intense to have none of those benefits, but also be paying 50-something percent on your marginal tax rate. What do you do to deal with that long term? So this is if you're filing your taxes in 2020, you're like, shoot, I really didn't deduct anything for retirement. I kind of screwed up. So the good news is you can change that for the future. And because of how high these tax rates are, marginal tax rates, you can max retirement. That should be your goal. I tell people to start off with doing 5% to retirement and 100 a month into a brokerage account. That's the first step. That's the baby step to get going from the very beginning. And then you want to focus on maxing your retirement account first. And then once you've done that, then you start putting money into your non-retirement account, because that's what you're going to be able to use to retire before the age of 60, because you can pull money out of a brokerage account without having to pay any penalties. Now, why do I tell people that you should limit your purchase price on your house to 2x your household income? And why do I tell people that their car payment is so important to eliminate and to pay cash for cars? Okay, the reason is when you are buying something that's basically a marginal amount of consumption, you're spending dollars that are earned on that last little extra bit of income. Okay, so the difference between a house that's 2x your income and 3x your income, basically that extra spending that you're doing is coming at a tax rate that's much higher than your overall tax rate. Because remember, that extra 20 or 30K or whatever that you're earning, that last little bit of income is being taxed at the highest rate. And when you make that lifestyle choice to get the maximum thing you qualify for instead of a decent thing that you qualify for, then you're paying way more in taxes to get that thing. And so what happens is if you do, the typical American behavior of two SUVs with car payments and a house that's 3.5x your income, that's your typical American that doesn't think, right? That means that there's just not a lot of money left over at all for doing things like saving for retirement. Really not much at all. And when you avoid doing that, then what's happening is your little bit of extra consumption prevents you from building any wealth at all. And then you're set up to work until you're 70 years old instead of 50, all because you wanted to have a house that was an extra 500 to 1,000 square feet that you don't really use except once per year. I mean, obviously, like some of the people, I'm going to get a little pushback. Maybe you're already thinking that this guy's full of it, right? But that's kind of what happens is when we stretch a little bit on big ticket items like housing and cars, it destroys our finances long term. It makes such a big difference, because remember, when you put your money into retirement, what happens? I said that a lot of people, even in low income situations, could be hit with 40 or 50% tax hits on that extra little bit of income they're making, right? So if you could put that money into retirement instead, you know, let's say that, you know, that money that would have gone into the car payment, that's going to max out your retirement instead. So then instead of having, you know, $1 million at age 70 or something and just praying Social Security is around, if you follow these guidelines for keeping your spending under control, then you're looking at, you know, being able to maybe retire in your early 50s instead. So it can make a difference where you're retiring 20 years sooner, or at least you have the option to. So in terms of retiring at 50, you might say that, well, you know, I really don't want to do that. I don't feel like I need to retire at 50, so I'm happy not having a high savings rate. So I just want to give you a personal story. My wife looked at me this morning, like at our breakfast table, and she looked over and she goes, okay, in her early 40s, I think I want to live in Paris for a year and be retired. And I was floored. And obviously, you don't know my wife like I do, but basically, like, she cares the least about money that I've of anyone I've ever met. And it's one of the reasons that I was attracted to her, because I probably care maybe too much about it sometimes in terms of optimizing things and trying to find loopholes. It's just my personality. For her, she really doesn't really care about money that much except as a tool, right? And so for her to say that she was, you know, into the idea of at least having the option to not have to work in her 40s, that was pretty big. That was pretty shocking to me. So if she kind of has these thoughts occasionally in her moments of weakness when she's waking up super early to go see a problem patient, right, then that might happen to you at some point. And that's why it's so important that you limit your spending to these kind of rules of thumb for these big ticket purchase items, just because of the difference of your life happiness if you have the option to stop working in your 50s versus your 70s or even 60s, right? It's just a big difference. Now, that was just long-term planning, just kind of introducing you to taxes. So just recap of what we talked about, right? We talked about the difference between your effective tax rate and your marginal tax rate. So your marginal tax rate is basically very, very high for most people. It's what they're getting taxed on that extra dollar they earn, and it's way higher than what your overall taxes are, right? So if you are looking for an excuse to go part-time, if you can cut your spending a little bit, you've done it. You've already gotten to where you need to be because of, again, that extra little, the next $1,000 you earn is just getting taxed at a big level, especially if you have student loans. Now, if you are a business owner, there are just plenty of things you can do to reduce your taxes. So if you are thinking long-term and you're thinking, maybe I should own my own business, please do that. Because if you do, you can do things like depreciation. You can write off some of the building that you have every year that's coming off of your taxes, off your taxable income. You also can deduct interest that you pay on practice loans. You can deduct equipment. You can deduct just all kinds of things. You get better retirement plans. You can even do a self-funded pension for some people and put away like $100,000 a year tax-free into retirement instead of the typical employee limit of $19,500. All kinds of things you can do as a business owner. So if you're interested in reducing taxes, definitely think about that, especially if you're in a medical field of any kind, and that is something that aligns with your long-term career goals. Okay, so all these things have been long-term things, and you're like, oh my gosh, I hope he talks about actual loopholes I can use this year, dang it. So I'm going to get into that now. So let's just jump right in. Let's talk about filing taxes, married filing joint, or married filing separate and single. So those are the three different ways you can file your taxes. If you're single, you're obviously not married, you're filing your taxes single. If you're married, basically, are you married legally in the eyes of any state government, right? If you're married legally, then you're going to have to file joint or separate. Now, the government really wants you to not file separate, just, I guess, maybe because it's just extra work on their part. I don't know why. What they do is they basically take you, your income, and they put you into those single brackets instead of combining all your income and letting you be a joint bracket. Now, the reason why that matters is if you have two spouses that make very different incomes, you're going to get a lower tax amount being married. Because, you know, let's say that, remember that tax bracket for married people? Let's say that, you know, the higher tax bracket starts at $300,000 and the same tax bracket starts at $150,000 if you're single, right? And let's say you make $200,000 and your spouse makes $20,000. So if you're married, then you're in that lower tax bracket. But if you're single, that person making $200,000 is going to get bumped up into a much higher tax bracket because they're above that limit for what it is for single. So in general, we see people's tax penalties for people making about the same amount of money being very low. We're talking like $100. I mean, like super, super low, right? For people that have very different incomes or just complex tax situations or something kind of weird going on, those tax penalties can sometimes be thousands of dollars. And in some rare cases, if you have somebody making, for example, $400,000 and the other spouse is making zero, then that tax penalty could be a low five-figure amount. So what do you get by filing your income taxes, married filing separately if you are married? the main benefit of this is if you have student loans and if you're on the right repayment plan, you can avoid paying with your spouse's income too. Now, we're actually able to suggest this like loophole to get around some of the penalty taxes, but I'll talk about that later. So let's just say that you just got married and you're looking at how is this going to affect my loans, right? It's probably one of the most common reasons people hire us, because that's when things get super complicated. And let's just say that you both have loans. So one person's got $150,000 of loans, one person has $50,000 of loans. So if you file your taxes jointly, they're just going to take all your income and they're going to calculate one giant combined payment. All right. So let's just say this married couple with $200,000 in debt, let's say their payment is $1,000 a month based off of their income, just to make it super easy, right? So 3/4 of that is going to go to the person with a large debt, and 1/4 of it's going to go to the person with the small debt. So $750 to the large debt person, $250 to the small debt person. So that's basically called the proportional distribution of payments for married couples. So this is something that people get confused all the time. I have a lot of people, I saw this guest post in a prominent personal finance site once where I was like, how we're saving $1 gazillion by filing separately on the repay plan. And I was like, oh, I got to read this, because I'm not aware of how you can both be on the repay plan and save money filing separate. So I read it and they were wrong. They mistakenly thought that you have your income double counted when you file jointly. So that's horribly wrong. And they were costing themselves thousands in taxes for absolutely no reason. So I left a comment to that effect and they updated the post and they were so grateful. They're like, oh, wow, I guess we don't know about our student loans as well as we thought. So that's how it works. And that proportional distribution of payments prevents married couples in general from paying way more than on their loans than they would pay if they were single. So that's good. You know, you don't want married couples and single people to have drastically different student loan payments, but that's if you both have loans. And also on the repay plan, you cannot file separately. It's always proportional payments, regardless of, you know, if the spouse has debt or no debt. Basically, they just take that proportional amount. That's what your repay payment is for each person. Now, there's this loophole called the fighting spouses loophole. So this is my own little moniker that I've come up with. If you have a better name than the fighting spouses loophole, please let me know. It's fighting spouses in a joking way. It's not literally you're trying to beat each other up or something or hurt each other. Okay. It's basically if you can't agree, maybe I should call it the arguing spouses loophole. Maybe it sounds a little bit more appropriate. Maybe the fighting spouses loophole, basically the repay and the pay plans, you would basically use both of them. So one person would be on pay, one person would be on repay, and you'd file your taxes separately. So how does this work? How could you use this with filing taxes separately? Let's give an example. So this has the best application for two spouses going for PSLF. So one spouse is let's say has $100,000 income and $300,000 of debt, and another spouse has $100,000 of income and $100,000 of debt. So there's $400,000 total. One spouse has got 3/4 of it, and there's $200,000 income in the household, and they each have similar incomes, right? So if you do married filing separately versus married filing jointly, what does that look like? So if you file joint, the payment is based off of the total household income. So that payment for a $200,000 household income is about $1,500 a month. About 3/4 of it goes to the person that's got the larger debt, and 1/4 of it goes to the person making the smaller debt. Real rough math, $300-$400 to the smaller, $1,200 to the larger. Okay. What if you wanted to pay less though? And so this is where this comes into play. So the person with the high debt to income ratio files married filing separately, and then the payment is based off of their income instead of the proportional payments. So they're on pay as you earn, and instead of paying about $1,100 or $1,200 a month, they're only going to pay about $700 a month. The cool thing is that the other spouse stays in the repay plan, their payment's still proportional, even though the other spouse is filing separately. So you actually get a significantly lower payment because the repay plan is about the same, $300-$400 a month, and then the other person's pay as you earn payments like $700 a month. So your total payment is around $1,000 a month instead of like $1,400-$1,500. That person's saving about $4,000 or $5,000 per year on their student loans. So LOL, doesn't that pay for a student loan consult with us? Ha ha ha. So sorry, my humor is barely better than Michael Bloomberg's. Ouch. So anyhow, if you're doing long-term forgiveness, then both of you doing PSLF, then maybe this makes sense for certain situations. But if you're doing 20-25-year forgiveness, or especially if one of you is doing PSLF and one of you is not doing PSLF, then this gets a little bit less attractive because eventually you'll have to pay the other spouse's loans off probably that you're benefiting from their low payment on their loans. So it doesn't work perfectly in every situation, but it's a nice little loophole to know about. And to do that, you have to file your taxes separately. So that's kind of a complicated one. So let's slow things down. So we just did the All I Do Is Win song with DJ Khaled and T-Pain and Lil Wayne and everybody, right? Snoop Dogg. We just got super hyped. So let's just calm it down, slow it down. Some really slow Backstreet Boys song. Okay. Calm things down a little bit. So now we're going to talk just about repay IBR, the basics, like if you file joint or separate. So if you file joint, the payment is going to be the same on the pay and the repay plans. And then that's because they're 10% of your income. And then IBR is 15%. But if you file separate, married filing separate, then your pay IBR payments are just based on your income. Is that payment less than what your payment is if you file jointly? That's kind of what we kind of look at. So if you're filing separately, one, is your tax penalty low? If it is, then yeah, definitely do pay if you can, if you're going for forgiveness. And then if your penalty is kind of on the high end, then maybe you don't file jointly because maybe that just makes you feel a little uncomfortable, right? But here's a sort of a simple example. So let's say that you know, you're a veterinarian, you have $300,000 of student loans, and you have $100,000 of income, and your spouse has $100,000 of income. So if you file jointly for taxes, then you're going to have a $1,500 a month payment. But if you file separate, your payment's only going to be like $700 or $800 a month. So that's a difference in payments of like $7,000 or $8,000 a year. It's a big difference in payments. And in the case with a pretty equal income, it's not going to be much of a tax penalty either. And PSA on this, when you file taxes separately, okay, so in 2020, if you do married filing separately, you update your income information, your loan company is still going to ask for your spouse's income. They're still going to ask them to sign stuff, and they're still going to want to see that. That's okay. They're not allowed to use it if you do married filing separately and you're on the pay or the income-based repayment plan. If you do repay, they're going to count your spouse's income no matter what. That's, you know, unless you get an incompetent person at Fed Loan Servicing that tells you to lie and say that you can't access your spouse's information because they don't know how to explain doing pay and filing taxes separately, right? So that's the difference. Just listen to your servicer on this stuff because a lot of times they just tell people totally incorrect information. And I've noticed a little bit of a downtick in the servicer telling people that when we wrote an article. I don't know if it's connected or at all, but we wrote an article on our site saying that, you know, Fed Loan's like telling people to commit fraud basically by telling people to say they can't access their spouse's income. And then suddenly I noticed a kind of a downtick in them doing that. So I don't know if it's related, probably giving myself a little bit too much credit there, but I like to think that we keep the loan servicers honest. That's our job. So again, if your spouse signs something or has to give income information when you file taxes separately, do not panic. That's normal. They're not supposed to take it into account for pay and IBR. Just remember that. Now, funny kind of story. A lot of times people freak out. They're like, I don't want, you know, to be responsible for this debt. Like, or, you know, spouse will even freak, like the person with the debt will freak out. They'll say like, I don't want them to have my spouse's income information. It's like, oh, it's okay. They're just kind of admitting that they're being truthful. They're not lying. That's all they're saying. They're not co-signing on it. What about amending your tax returns? What if you have some older tax returns that you filed separately? You can amend married filing separate tax returns from separate to joint and get all that money back. Now, here's kind of the catch is this is a gray area. This has never been green lighted by the IRS or the loan servicer people as to whether or not you can do this with student loans. We think it's okay. I mean, we think it's okay to do because basically you're just going back in time and amending your tax returns from separate to joint. As long as you don't do it immediately after you certify your income for your student loans, that's where we kind of think the line is definitely too far. So for example, let's say you do married filing separate, you send Fed Loan or Nelnet or whatever your income information. They accept it, give you your new payment, and then you immediately go and amend your tax return. Well, that makes it look like you just did it because of the loans and that's it. I mean, it just makes it real blatant. Whereas remember, you have that 3-year look back window. So if you go back in and you amend your old tax returns from separate to joint, if you wait for that tax return to be at least 2 years old and no longer involved in the recertification process, in other words, you're already using a new tax return for your income driven repayment. Now your old tax return is not being used for your income-driven repayment at all, and you already have a new tax return that's more recent. So as long as your new tax return is filed and it's being used with your new IDR payment, so in other words, your IDR payment is not related to your tax return at all from the prior couple of years ago, then go ahead and consider amending it from separate to joint and getting that money back. That can sometimes be, you know, like I said, a couple thousand dollars to some sort of mid-four-figure amount, depending on your tax situation. So that's can be meaningful. Now, what are some other weird things for you to think about? So let's talk about some weird stuff. Now we're going to talk about community property states. You know, so that intro is a little terrible, but community property states, let me list you the 9 community property states out there. There's Arizona, California, Idaho, Louisiana, Nevada, New Mexico, Texas, Washington State, and Wisconsin. Those are the 9 community property states. And if you live in one of those states, your student loan situation, if you have 6 figures of student loan debt, is going to be very, very complicated if you're married. Very complicated. And the reason for that is basically you can blame the Mexican-American War. So in the 1840s, this is kind of a super weird, you know, history lesson, right? But the Mexican-American War, Robert E. Lee and Ulysses S. Grant actually fought on the same side, right? America fought Mexico to expand the size of the United States. So we took half of Mexico by force and doubled the size of the country. In a lot of these places that we took over after the Mexican-American War, they had Spanish civil laws, right? Basically based on Spanish civil code instead of English civil code. So in a lot of these places, they sort of just kept the laws in place. And if you kind of think about community property states, that's why if you kind of draw a line from like Louisiana all the way to California, all those states are community property states if you just follow that line. And then if you tack on Washington State, for example, Oregon is kind of a weird exception. And then the only kind of really random one is Wisconsin. I don't understand, you know, they're not, you know, related to Spanish civil code. Maybe it's like the French civil code, or maybe it was just Wisconsin people are weird. I don't know. I'm just joking. But those are the community property states. And why does that matter for you? When you file your taxes in a community property state, if you file joint, there's absolutely nothing that you're going to notice that's any different from anybody else. But if you file married filing separate, then what happens is you need to use a form called Form 8958. And it equally distributes your income across both spouses in community property states when you file taxes separate. So if you do that, and let's say that one spouse makes $200K and one spouse makes zero. So in a state like New York without community property law, you're going to have $200K and then zero. And so you're probably just going to file taxes jointly. And you're probably just going to do pay or repay and do filing taxes jointly because the penalty would be so large to file separate and it wouldn't really even benefit you. But in a community property state, if you file taxes separate, now your income is 100 and 100. It's evened out. So when you file taxes separate, your tax penalty is basically nothing. And then you get to pay 10% if you're doing the pay-as-you-earn plan. You get to pay 10% of $100,000 instead of 10% of $200,000. So that is the breadwinner loophole. I think that's probably a better named loophole than the fighting spouses loophole. I got to come up with something better than that. But that's a really interesting and powerful loophole. Now, the flip side to that is, what if you're the lower earning spouse? What if you're making $40,000 and you're married to somebody making $100,000? And let's say that you're a teacher and you live in a community property state and you file your taxes separately. Well, now instead of paying on $40,000 of income under pay as you earn, you're going to have to pay on half of your household income, which is $70,000. So that's a little bit worse, right? So how do you avoid paying on $70,000? Well, what you can do is do something called alternative documentation of income. And to do that, you basically submit your pay stub, and they're going to go off of your pay stub instead of your tax return, which will give you a much lower payment in a community property state if you're the one making the lower income instead of your spouse. That's just a couple of the things to think about. The one thing that I can tell you is this: you can never file joint and switch it to separate, but you can always file separate and switch it to joint. So remember that if you're kind of confused as to which one you should do, and you both have student loans, probably file your taxes separately if the penalty is not massive, you know, and then even if it is, you can amend it if you figured out you made a mistake and you shouldn't have filed separate. You know, if you're going for forgiveness, consider filing separate and then getting professional advice as to whether or not that was a good idea, because you can undo it. Now, what if you just are paying back your loans? If you're paying back your loans, then you want to file jointly, right? Like if you want to pay back your loans in full, no forgiveness, it's very straightforward. Just file your taxes married filing jointly. The only thing that I would add if you're refinancing your loans is, if you're going for refinancing, they're going to want proof of income. And if you're an employee, that's really easy. They're going to ask you for pay stubs. But if you're a business owner, basically they're going to ask you for 2 years of tax returns. unless you're one of the golden professions like dentistry, physicians, or something like that, where they'll accept 1 year of tax returns for your business. But that's a great time to refinance, is when you can prove as a business owner that your income is much higher because you're turning in your tax return. So keep that in mind if you need to pay back your debt and that you're not considering going for forgiveness, then hey, get a great looking tax return and use that to refinance, because rates are the lowest they've really ever been right now because of all the weird stuff going on in the economy. A couple comments about this. It's helpful to have a CPA if you have complicated tax situations. If you have just W-2 and you're just an employee, you don't need a CPA to do your taxes. You can just get somebody like at, you know, H&R Block or like TurboTax. You can probably do it yourself super easily. You don't need a lot of help to do your taxes. We do have a partnership with a tax firm, studentloanplanner.com/tax. So if you have been procrastinating, you know, reach out to them if you feel like you're having no clue what to do with your taxes this year. Now, the thing about tax people is they're not going to know about why you would do a specific tax filing status because of your student loans, right? They're not going to be able to tell you whether you should do married joint or married filing separate. They're not going to be able to tell you that, because to be able to tell you that, they would have to be able to know all the loan rules. And in my experience, there's probably only a handful of CPA tax people in the country that are even well-versed in this stuff, because it's extremely complicated. And some of these loopholes that I've found out about over time, to be honest, like, I mean, they're news to me. Like, I mean, some of these loopholes, you know, we kind of figure it out over time, just like applying the complex rules to thousands of situations, and we find new ones. So there's no way that people can keep up with all these loopholes. It's just, it's very hard. I mean, there is a way you would do this full time, right? But your tax person is going to know a lot about taxes, and they'll be able to give you a tax estimate for how much it'll cost filing joint and filing separate. But we'll be able to tell you which one we think you should do because of your student loans and why. So if you're looking for clarity this tax season and you have a lot of student loan debt, if you have never hired us before, go to studentloanplanner.com/help and hire us for a student loan plan, because like I showed you, some of these random loopholes, you kind of pay for the consult 10x in the first year. And that's, you know, assuming that you don't even save anything in future years. And then if you are already a client, then obviously we have our follow-up consult that we have announced is basically $100 cheaper than the initial consult rate. So, you know, just hit us up if you're having questions with tax season coming up. And, you know, obviously tax season can be a stressful time for a lot of people because it's something you just want to get over with. But it's important to get it right, because if you don't, you could pay the equivalent of a brand new, well, I shouldn't have said brand new, because now I have to think like Chevy Spark or Chevy Aveo or like some really bad car for $10,000. It's brand new. How about a really nice used Toyota Camry, right? You could save that amount in 1 year very, very easily as a five-figure income family just by getting your tax filing status correct and done the right way. So that's really pretty powerful. I don't know if that doesn't excite you. I don't know what does, because if you made it through to this point in the podcast and you're still listening about taxes, wow, you're a special person. You're probably going to be super rich one day. You just need to make sure that you take the right steps, make the right choices, and get help when you know that something is more complex than you really want to deal with. Hit us up, studentloanplanner.com/help, and BT Dubs, I would love to get your questions for the show. If you have any questions, tax season, you know, my loans are too big, what do I do? You know, my person who, like, you know, I sometimes go to the movie theater, people ask me about like how they can avoid getting their tax refunds not garnished, right, and not taken from them because they're in student loan default, and they see I wear my student loan planner t-shirt sometimes when I go to the movies, and it's pretty bad when you get stopped and people are like, hey, usually it's weird, they pull you aside and they're like, hey, help me. Whatever you're dealing with tax season or just wealth building in general, hit us up, studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. We'd love to get your questions. Thanks so much, y'all. You have a wonderful week.